Welcome to the podcast that's all about solutions. If you get that the coercive state is the problem, but you're tired of complaining about it, this is the place for you. Join us as we ask, what then must we do? I'm here today with Jeremy Hammond. Jeremy is a repeat guest here. We've spoken many times about COVID, about masks, about the vaccines. Jeremy is an intrepid independent journalist, one of the few who's actually been doing journalism these past few years. Welcome again to the show.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
So what I wanted to talk with you about today is something we're not supposed to talk about. In fact, we can probably count on having this banned from any number of sites. I won't even try putting it up on YouTube. Do vaccines cause autism?
I believe they do.
Okay, so
I believe we have sufficient evidence to conclusively say that they do.
Now, when you say that, do you mean that everyone is at risk? Any child who gets a vaccine is at risk, or do you have to belong to a certain genetic? Do you have to have a certain genetic makeup? Let's start off by just what do you think the risk is?
Yeah, I think that there are subpopulations of children who are susceptible, whether due to genetic susceptibility or, you know, environmentally caused susceptibility. You know, maybe they have higher exposures to environmental toxins. So that would be like an environmental susceptibility. Could be genetic. For example, mitochondrial disorders have been. In fact, the government has acknowledged. In the case of Hannah Poehling, with the vaccine injury compensation program, the government has acknowledged that the vaccine she received caused fever, caused brain inflammation, resulted in encephalopathy, which resulted in symptoms of autism. She regressed into diagnosed autism after receiving 9 vaccine doses at once at 19 months of age, and the government acknowledged that the vaccine caused her her injury. The director of the CDC went on CNN at the time and said, you know, everyone knows that vaccines can cause fevers, and sometimes this can trigger some damage, and sometimes that damage can be, you know, I forget how she worded it exactly. She tried to weasel word it a little bit, but it's essentially like symptoms like autism, like symptoms or something like that. But of course, autism is defined by its symptoms. So essentially she acknowledged that it caused her autism. And she had a mitochondrial disorder. It does appear to be quite certain that there are certain children. It's the same with other injuries as well. I mean, every child, you know, the government likes to have this blanket one-size-fits-all policy. Vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. Everyone gets vaccinated, which is insane. It's so unscientific because every child is at a different risk of the diseases that the vaccines are intended to protect against. They're not all at the equal risk from the disease, and they're not all at the same risk of vaccine injuries. And the government has just not put any effort into trying to understand what are the risk factors for vaccine injuries. So what are the factors that put children at higher risk of having a vaccine injury, including injuries that can manifest as symptoms of autism? And they seem completely uninterested in doing that research, which is tragic. Right.
In fact, there was, maybe you can talk a little bit about the IOM report from, was it 2004? Which actually started to point in the direction of, I mean, I don't remember the exact words, but they also said something to the effect of, you know, vaccines could possibly be contributing to autism and we should do more research. But then they didn't recommend doing more research.
Right. Yes. The Institute of Medicine reviews, there's been several. The 2004 one, I think, focused largely on thimerosal, which is the, It's the mercury-based preservative that was used in childhood vaccines. They withdrew it around the turn of the century from most vaccines. It's still used in multi-dose vials of influenza vaccine. So this is the mercury-based preservative. It's about half ethyl mercury by weight. And so this was the review that the CDC likes to cite, saying vaccines do not cause autism. They cite the 2004 review. They also say, you know, the mercury in vaccines doesn't cause autism and is harmless. And they cite this report, but that's not what the review found. That wasn't their conclusion at all. They did conclude that the evidence favors rejection of the hypothesis that vaccines can cause autism. However, they didn't say vaccines don't cause autism. There's a big difference. And the reason they specifically worded their conclusion that way is because they're looking at observational studies. You know, the CDC, you know, the CDC cites a number of observational studies and the IOM review. And the IOM review pointed out that observational studies can't disprove the hypothesis. Mm-hmm. because, you know, they're prone to selection biases. For example, healthy user bias, or healthy vaccinee bias, where a really, really insightful paper, I think, that illuminates this problem was 2015. Jane et al., I think it was, and I think that was the, I think it was JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association, or maybe it was New England Journal of Medicine. I don't remember the journal exactly, but one of the major journals. They published a study on MMR and autism. And of course, all the headlines and all the media were another study shows that, you know, once again proves that vaccines don't cause autism. And the authors of that study actually concluded that their findings, they had a finding of no association between the MMR and autism. And what made this study different from other ones is that they claimed that it did show no association even in children who had a genetic susceptibility. So this was kind of a unique study in that regard, because all of the other studies, none of them even considered the possibility of genetically susceptible children. And this is, again, one of the reasons why the IOM pointed out that, you know, these studies don't falsify the hypothesis. You know, yes, they found no association, but this could be a type 2 error, which is basically a false negative, right? You can fail to find an association that does exist, just like you can find an association that doesn't really exist, which would be a type 1 error, a false positive. And so, yeah, the IOM pointed this out, that, you know, this is a problem with observational studies. They can have these selection biases. So in Jane et al., they defined genetic susceptibility reasonably. It's kind of a limited definition, but they reasonably said, well, okay, if a child has an older sibling with autism, okay, likely they share, you know, the same genetic susceptibility. So, you know, that's kind of a reasonable assumption as a basis. It's very limited. I mean, there can be all kinds of other possible susceptibilities and definitions of susceptibility, but that's what they chose for this purpose of the study. And the interesting thing is that you cannot logically draw the conclusion that they found no association from their findings. Because although they didn't find an association, what they did find was essentially a healthy user bias, whereby it wasn't that children who, you know, younger siblings who had an older sibling with autism, it wasn't that they were no more likely to develop autism than children who weren't considered genetically susceptible. It's that the younger siblings, the parents of those children, are less likely to vaccinate them with MMR because they have the older sibling with autism. And so when it comes to the younger child, their second or third child, whatever it might be, the parents are more cautious and they don't want to do the MMR. And so there you go. So what happens is you have the non-genetically susceptible children are pooled into the vaccinated cohort, whereas the genetically susceptible children are pooled into the unvaccinated cohort. And so this is a selection bias. This was the actual significant finding of that study, is that they identified this selection bias. And so to claim that, well, this study proves that there's no association is completely the wrong conclusion. The right conclusion is we need more studies that control for this selection bias.
And is that what they said?
No, of course not. They concluded that, you know, this study finds no association, and that's
even
that.
Though they recognized
they just wiped
the
their hands
bias.
Clean of it. Yeah, and they acknowledged right in the paper that they did find that, you know, the genetically susceptible children had a lower rate of MMR vaccination. So they acknowledged, but they didn't describe it as a selection bias. You know, it's mm-hmm. kind of like they just mentioned it, and that really is the true significant finding of that study. And it's interesting because the only other study that has considered, you know, that the authors claim to have considered genetic susceptibility was Hvid et al.,
right,
which was
the Danish study. Yeah.
What was it, 2018 or 2019?
Yeah.
And that's the more recent one. And interestingly, they cited Jane et al. From 2015. So they know perfectly well about this selection bias.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they don't mention it. You know, Hvid et al. In the Danish study, they don't mention this selection bias, and they don't control for it.
So they repeat
the
same.
That tells you something.
Yeah.
It tells you something. So they knew that if they designed the study the way that they did, that likely they're going to be taking advantage of this selection bias, which biases their study in favor of finding of no association, right?
Right. And weren't there a bunch of conflicts of interest with that study too?
Yes. Yeah. The authors and the funders, of course, were had ties to the vaccine industry. I mean, the one of the organizations that funded this study actually is responsible for like the distribution of vaccines in Denmark. And so they were tied right into the whole vaccine industry and the public health establishment in Denmark. So that's one issue, which of course helps to explain the biases in the study. And another thing is that right from the get-go, in terms of their exclusion criteria, they excluded, you know, they claimed to have done the study to consider genetic susceptibility. But right off the bat, they excluded children who had a number of different conditions that placed them at higher risk. Autism. And so that's fraudulent, because what they're doing is they're saying, okay, that condition is a competing hypothesis. So if those children get vaccinated and develop autism, they'll say, oh, it wasn't the vaccine, it was their genetic condition.
Mm-hmm.
When the reality is, it could be very well that that genetic condition places those children at higher risk of vaccine injury,
right,
manifesting as symptoms, right, of autism. So this is a trick that they do quite frequently in studies.
Wow.
Well, they'll treat potential risk factors for vaccine injury as competing hypotheses. And so they'll exclude those children from the study. So in fact, they're not actually considering genetic susceptibility. They're narrowing their definition of genetic susceptibility specifically in a way,
right,
that increases the odds of that selection bias identified by Jane et al. In 2015.
Yeah.
And so I think this is a really good example of how you can design studies to fail to find an association. Like it's as though they deliberately designed the study to find no association, which of course they did. And of course the media all cite the study as yet more proof that vaccines don't cause autism. It doesn't prove that,
right,
because of the inherent biases in this study design.
The other thing that we see a lot with the studies that people throw up as, you know, definitive proof is it will only look at the MMR vaccine, or it will only, right, look at Temarisol. Are there any studies that look at the entire vaccine schedule?
No,
nothing,
one.
Nothing.
No, and in fact, you know, this was another thing that the IOM had said in one of their reviews. I forget which year. There's been a number of IOM reviews. I think the 2004 was focused primarily on the Thimerosal question. There was another one in 2012. There was one in 2013 that explicitly stated that, you know, what parents want, what, you know, stakeholders, including parents, what they want is a vaccinated versus unvaccinated study. This is what
seems
people
like
are
a
demanding.
Simple thing.
This is what people are asking for. And of course, they recommended that the CDC look into, they advised against doing like a randomized trial, you know, based on the the argument that this would be unethical, but which of course begs the question. It's right. The fallacy of begging the question. Right. You're presuming the proposition to be proven, which is that the vaccines.
Yeah. Then why do any double blind studies at all?
Right.
If that's the argument.
Right. Exactly. So that whole, you know, it's unethical argument is a fallacy. But setting that aside, so they said, well, but the CDC has the VSD, the Vaccine Safety Data Link, right?
Right.
And so the CDC could go into there and use that data, which is it's in collaboration with a number of different like health maintenance organizations. So they have this patient data, and the IOM recommended that the CDC investigate ways to do the type of study that people want, which is the vaccinated, unvaccinated study. And in my book, The War on Informed Consent, I talk about that, and I kind of bring it right up to date in terms of where the CDC is at on that. And I cite a document that the CDC where the CDC discusses, you know, its considerations of using the VSD to compare the, you know, the health of vaccinated versus unvaccinated.
Let me guess, they're very, very concerned about patient privacy. Is that it?
It's not so much that. It's just more that they say, well, their excuse is that, well, there's not a big enough control group. They don't have enough. There's not enough vaccinated children in the system because they vaccinated away the entire control group.
Right.
So there's one excuse, right? So they, you know, that they're like, well, we couldn't get statistically significant results because there's not enough unvaccinated kids in the system. So
why not look at it? Now, is this data that someone else could presumably get by filing a FOIA or taking them to court?
No, it's very tightly controlled by the CDC, mm-hmm. and it is because it's patient data, you know, from the health care organization. So the CDC has at times allowed independent researchers access to the VSD data, but you know it's very tightly restricted, and it typically like only CDC researchers ever are able to access this data. And essentially what the CDC, this document from the CDC, kind of this follow-up on the IOM recommendation, essentially just concluded that what we need to do is a vaccinated versus unvaccinated study. Like they won't do it. They won't do the vaccinated versus unvaccinated study. They flat out refuse. And then, of course, they find all kinds of excuses why it can't be done. But then you have a number of independent researchers who have published.
Right.
Looking at like finding clinics where they have a pretty high proportion, you know, a higher than usual proportion of patients who are completely unvaccinated. There was the Madsen study, Brian Hooker, mm-hmm. along with Neil. What's his name? Sorry, I forget.
Yeah. Neil Miller. Yeah. Yeah.
And, so they published one also, but the biggest and best one to date is the study by James Lyons Weiler and Dr. Paul Thomas.
So let's talk about that a little bit. And I know you and I talked about it earlier, and I've had Dr. Thomas on talking about what happened to him after he published this. How does this, as far as study design and how they did this, how does it stack up against, for example, the studies, you know, purporting to show that there is no connection?
Well, again, most of the studies purporting, you know, finding no association, either they would look at one vaccine, MMR, mm-hmm. or they would look at just one ingredient, thimerosal. And so it wasn't really a vaccinated versus unvaccinated study. Another thing is that, you know, they would do like, you know, it's like vaccinated versus vaccinated. Maybe it's more highly vaccinated versus less highly vaccinated, something like this. There's just not, amongst that whole body of research cited by the CDC, there isn't a study that compared, okay, well, these children got vaccines, these children didn't. Like, it doesn't exist. And so that's one unique thing about independent research that has been done, including Dr. Thomas's study. And so what he did, of course, he doesn't have a very large number of children in his practice, his former practice.
Right.
because unfortunately he was forced out by the state. But he didn't have a large number of children in his study who like followed the CDC schedule. I mean, because the whole founding principle of his practice was informed consent. And just empowering the parents to be able to make their own informed choices and kind of just giving them the information they need to kind of do what they felt was best, you know, an individualized risk benefit analysis, which is, of course, that's the scientific approach. The CDC's one size fits all solution is completely unscientific. So Dr. Thomas took a scientific approach, and therefore a lot of variable vaccination, you know, like schedules that parents would follow, because every family would kind of have their own individualized plan and schedule that they would follow. And so it wasn't a CDC schedule versus unvaccinated schedule. This is really important.
Yeah. It's actually
variably vaccinated. Yeah. Versus unvaccinated.
And very, my understanding is, you know, no, I don't think any of these parents were vaccinating above the CDC schedule. This was all sort of, there probably weren't a whole lot of parents who were even doing the entire schedule. So it's, as you say, it's not even a comparison of CDC schedule versus nothing. It's
right.
Probably like minimal vaccination versus right. No vaccination.
Yeah. In a recent interview, one of his shows, not an interview, but, you know, Paul Thomas has his show With the Wind that he does. In one of his recent episodes, he discussed, he discussed the question of do I recommend the vaccine friendly plan anymore? So for people who might not be aware, he wrote the book, The Vaccine Friendly Plan.
Yeah.
Co-authored with Dr. Jennifer Margulis. And the idea behind the vaccine friendly plan, it provided, number one, the idea was, you know, again, there has to be an individualized approach, like individualized mm-hmm. risk benefit analyses. But he did give it like an example schedule in the book that was really specifically designed to just try to reduce the amount of aluminum exposure from vaccines, either by choosing, you know, like for example, just like hepatitis B, why give that at birth? It's an right. aluminum containing vaccine. Most children are at risk. Like, why give that universally at birth? It doesn't make any sense. So skip that one. You know, can maybe do it later on, something like this. And you know, sometimes there might be different version, you know, different brands of vaccines that have more or less aluminum. So like picking the brands that have less aluminum. So he was really, or spacing them out and not giving a bunch of aluminum containing shots at once. So a really common sense kind of approach with the schedule. And interestingly, you know, Dr. Thomas, in that recent episode, described how, you know, explained how I cannot recommend my own book anymore because it's still way too much aluminum.
Wow.
And him and Dr. Jack, Dr. James Lyons Weiler also previously had done a study looking at the aluminum exposure, comparing the CDC schedule to his vaccine friendly plan. And of course, his plan was, you know, significantly reduced. And yet he still feels today that it's still like recklessly high amounts of aluminum if parents were to follow that plan. So he said, like, I don't recommend my book anymore. You know, and he explained it, the book still has a place for parents who are like, you know, like they're going to vaccinate no matter what.
Right. Then it's better.
And so it's kind of like if they want some guidance to at least try to mitigate the risk, it still has that value. But just generally speaking, you know, he advises, you know, don't follow that plan because it's too much aluminum.
Yeah.
So
well, and the results from his study seem to bear that out.
Yeah. And so again, that's why it's really important to point out that it wasn't a CDC, because it's already, mm-hmm. you're already comparing the unvaccinated to children who were receiving fewer vaccines, and spacing them out more and doing all those types of things. And so, you know, the logical corollary is if we were to do a study comparing unvaccinated to CDC schedule children, then you know the disparity in health outcomes would be even greater. So that was the finding of the study. Thomas's study with Dr. Jack was that the health outcomes of the broad range of health outcomes of the unvaccinated children, they had superior health. They were just much healthier.
Right, because there's
a stark graph in the paper, like showing cumulative incidence.
Because it wasn't just about autism, right? It was also, they looked at a lot of chronic conditions. So I remember mm-hmm. asthma, I mean, autism was there. Asthma, autism, I think skin conditions. Did they look
skin
at
skin conditions,
cancer?
Other infections, eye infections, ear infections, yeah, allergies, ear infections, asthma. I mean, it's just a whole broad range of conditions. In fact, they couldn't do autism because he had too few he had too few patients in his practice that had autism, which is remarkable in itself, because if you compare the rate of autism in his practice to the CDC, the CDC's estimate for the general population in the US, his children have way lower rates of autism. In fact, five times lower rate of autism in his practice than you know, the net nationwide estimate from the CDC.
Right. Didn't he have, I thought there was a chart for like neurological issues or something. There was something.
Yeah, there was ADHD.
ADHD may have been.
Yeah, it was one of the disorders that was included. And again, just far, in fact, there was zero in the unvaccinated group, zero cases of ADHD.
Wow. Wow. So, I want to just take a moment and mention your book, because you wrote a whole book about this, and it's right behind you, The War on Informed Consent.
Yes.
And I'll link to it. I'll link to it in the show notes. I just want to say that this is a hugely important book, because it's not just about Dr. Thomas. It's really about how the science of vaccines and vaccine safety in particular, how that is done, or rather how it's not done. And it's also about how there's an active effort at silencing critique of vaccines. And I think, you know, because of what happened with Dr. Thomas, and he's not the only one, I think it's also an indictment of medical licensing itself, because that's how. Do you want to talk a little bit about what happened to Dr. Thomas after he published this study?
Yeah, so that study was published, if memory serves, November 22nd. Was it 2019?
I don't remember now.
The pandemic messed up my memory. Remember things that happened before it.
Years. Yeah.
And within days, the Oregon Medical Board. So he has, you know, his practice was in Portland, Oregon. The medical board held an emergency meeting and emergently suspended his license. Like days after that study was published. The ironic thing about that was that it was the medical board that had demanded that Dr. Thomas produce peer-reviewed evidence to support his alternative approach, which was, of course, like not pushing the CDC schedule on his patients, right? Which is just that there's multiple ironies in that, because of course the CDC has never done the vaccinated unvaccinated study. The CDC can't point to any peer-reviewed evidence that its schedule is superior to any other schedule. Like it can't do that because it's never done that research. And yet,
yeah.
So the medical board was demanding more, it had a higher evidentiary demand of Dr. Thomas than the CDC.
And then when he produced it, they kicked him out of his practice.
And then, yeah, exactly. So then they suspended his license after he met their demand and produced that evidence.
And it was peer reviewed, just to be clear. It was
yes, this was peer reviewed. So he had his license suspended, and of course he was fighting that for a long time. It got to be just too much of a burden. I mean, it was just, you know, the legal costs and everything involved, and just this, you know, all kinds of you can't even imagine the personal stresses, you know, that caused for his family, and it just eventually he just had to kind of give up that fight. Because it was too much of a burden.
Presumably a lot of practitioners never get into that fight because they see what happens to Dr. Thomas or to Dr. Sears in California or other doctors.
Yes.
You know, they see that this is what happens if you go against the vaccine religion. And
that was the message.
Yeah.
From the medical board. That was the message was to other doctors in the state. You had better bully your patients into following the CDC's schedule. If you don't, we're coming after your license. It was a loud and clear message to every doctor in the state.
Right. And you probably don't have an answer to this question, but are there any pediatricians now in Oregon who you can go to and not be bullied into doing the whole schedule?
Dr. Thomas was a gem. He was a rarity. I don't know any other. Of course, I'm not in Oregon. I'm in Michigan. Yeah. I don't know of anyone. Dr. Sears was another example in California. So doctors who respect informed consent and help enable their patients, you know, the parents of their pediatric patients, to exercise their right to informed consent and their right to make their own informed choices. The state governments are going after those doctors.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is why the book is titled "The War on Informed Consent."
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. And a lot of parents, especially in sort of health-minded, more health-aware communities, I guess I would say, just don't go to pediatricians anymore. I mean, parents have sort of started to see that for the most part, those well visits are really about pushing vaccines. And yes, if your child has an issue, you can go to a general practitioner, you know, if you can still, you know, find one who will take children. But
yeah,
I think a lot of parents are kind of catching on to what this is about and just ditching that whole profession.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually at the time I wrote, the book was adapted from a very lengthy article I had written. Mm-hmm. And when I published that article, we were still with a certain pediatric practice. And between the publication of the article and the publication of the book, we were expelled. So we were expelled from that practice for not following the CDC schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll disclose, my son is completely unvaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just recently wrote an article where I was talking about, talking about that same episode of Dr. Paul's With the Wind that I was mentioning earlier. And he was kind of, you know, he made the point in that video where, like, a message for parents who are like, don't want to talk about their children's vaccination status, right? For understandable reasons, like who yeah. wants to put the target on their back and,
yeah.
And have the confrontations with friends and family or whatever. But, you know, he had this message for us, and it was, you know, you guys have precious knowledge, and it's just, it's you can't hold on to that. You have to share it. You have to share that precious knowledge. And so that kind of encouraged me to, like, no longer just say, well, I had disclosed previously that, you know, our son was not following the CDC schedule. But it made me realize, you know what, why not? And my reason was just, wasn't any concern about, you know, me being attacked or anything. It was just more like concern for my son's privacy, that I wouldn't, you know, don't talk about his vaccination status. But I think Dr. Thomas made an excellent point, and he kind of persuaded me to kind of come out and say, you know, my son's completely unvaccinated. He's happy. He's healthy. He's super smart. He's my pride and joy. And so for not vaccinating, we were expelled from the practice. And I published an article on my website describing that incident and sharing the letter that I wrote to the pediatricians in that group practice. There are four of them, so I wrote one letter to each of them, and the same content, but addressed each of them individually. And just basically excoriating them for their ignorance and their arrogance and their condescension and their insults to my intelligence and my wife's intelligence. I encourage people to check that article out.
Yeah,
I'll share it with you later. We can put it in the show notes or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think it's a really good, you know, maybe inspirational for other parents who are facing these bullying pediatricians.
Yeah, I think there is something. I think there's something really valuable about that. To just if nothing else, to let other parents know that they're not alone, and that, you know, because you're being bullied in this room where you're the only one, and you don't have a whole bunch of people with signs, you know, cheering you on. But the reality is, there are a lot of people out here, you know, in the same boat. I do think it's helpful to speak out. We went through a similar thing. We were in Connecticut before we moved to California, and we were kicked out of a pediatrician's practice. Then we also don't vaccinate, and we were kicked out of a practice. You know, we were getting ready to move, and so we just didn't bother to fight it or, you know, write letters or anything. And there are so many incidents like that that have sort of happened that I would love to, like, you know, get back to that person now and say, hey, here's why you're, I've done it a couple times, but not every time. But, you know, we're not the only ones. And I think it gives a little bit of sort of courage maybe to parents who are maybe just on the fence. Maybe they don't know what, you know, what, which way they want to go, but they can tell they're being bullied. And that's really the only word for it, because that's exactly what they do.
And I left a Google review on their
nice business. Oh, see, I should go back. It was so long ago now.
Where I said, I explained like... exactly what happened. I said right in there,
yeah,
they expelled us for not following the CDC schedule. And so I, you know, right there, it's public, it's on Google Maps.
Nice, nice.
And so other people like looking up the clinic can see my review. And I warned parents, like I said, you know, if you're looking for pediatricians that are going to respect your right to make your own informed choices, this is not the practice for you.
Nice.
So
nice.
I did take that step as well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Because, I think for a long, I mean, even myself for a very long time, it's just something I didn't really talk about publicly. I didn't go into the whole vaccine debate, partly because it is very complex and there's so much. If you're going to make the case for something, you've really got to dig into it and know what you're talking about. Yeah. But at a certain point, it became clear that you know, these people are waging war on us. They really are trying to force us to take this stuff that can be harmful. And so at a certain point, you know, maybe everybody doesn't have to speak out, but I feel like the ones who I feel like there's definitely power and there's good to be done by speaking out.
Yeah, I think a lot of parents kind of just follow their intuition in choosing to not vaccinate. Mm-hmm. But you know, when they may be intimidated to speak out just because they feel like they don't have the knowledge to kind of support their intuition.
Yeah.
But the key really is, like, once you acquire a certain level of knowledge about vaccines and vaccine safety and how the studies are done, the institutionalized biases, you know, with the whole public health establishment and the scientific community and where the funding comes from.
Yeah.
Like when you understand what a big scam it all is, essentially, and all the fraud that exists.
Yeah.
And how, you know, there's fraudulent research. There's, you know, a lot of times when you start reading studies and, you know, you go directly to the source, you know, you go to PubMed. I mean, that's what I did. You know, when I started researching vaccines, like really intently, it wasn't for journalism purposes. It was to make decisions for our son. And so I just went, you know, I went to PubMed.gov and I just started reading the literature, and I expected to find a lot of disparity between, you know, like what the government and media say, science says, and what the science actually says. I was totally anticipating that, but I was really blown away at just how huge that disparity is. You know, there's just huge gap between what we're told and the reality of what science actually says. And so that was kind of, and it's still to this day, like there's always things I'm reading and it's just like, oh my gosh, I can't, this is like mind blowing, you know, how can this be?
Yeah.
So still, like, there's just things that I learned that it blows my mind.
Yeah. Or you'll see a headline, you'll see, you know, something in the mainstream, you know, something about, you know, yet another study that proves vaccines don't cause autism or something, the COVID vaccine is safe, something along those lines. And when you look at the study, it's not just that it doesn't say that, it sometimes says the opposite.
Yes. Well, and that's, you know, so you start to get kind of good, you kind of develop the skill of reading studies and kind of, you know, one of the things you have to watch out for is, you know, even if you're reading the methods section, might be full of, you know, stuff that's just way over your head, but you can at least read the abstract. You can kind of read the introduction.
Yeah.
You know, if the whole methods section is just too complicated to really understand, you can kind of skip that and then read the discussion section, right? You kind of learn how to read studies. And what you got to watch out for is a lot of times study authors who are very biased, you know, they have conflicts of interests, and they'll draw conclusions that don't follow from their findings. And I already gave one example of that earlier with Jane Adele.
Yeah.
The conclusion is that not that, oh, there's no association between MMR and vaccination and autism. The conclusion was there's a healthy user bias in these studies with MMR vaccine, and therefore we need to do additional research to control for this selection bias. So you got to watch out for authors like drawing conclusions that don't actually follow from their findings.
Yeah,
this is a big issue. And of course, you know, there's also like publication biases with the journals,
mm-hmm.
where if you're writing and if you've written a paper, if you've done research that paints vaccines in a negative light, you know, you found some harms or you found an association between vaccination and some harm, for example, those types of studies are just harder to get published. Whereas you can publish any crap that that says vaccines are great and everyone needs to get them and they're safe and effective.
Right.
I mean, there's all kinds of garbage.
And why is that? Is there a conflict of interest there with the journals and that message?
I think oftentimes there are, sometimes there could be advertising. Some of the journals, you go to their websites and they have like pharmaceutical advertisements and things. And that can be a factor. But I think it's more just like an institutionalized bias. It's what I call the vaccine religion, which is a mm-hmm. subsect of the state religion, to borrow a phrase yeah. from Noam Chomsky, where the state religion, you know, was something I talked about often when I was focused on foreign policy matters, where, you know, journalists are not immune to this kind of this bias, where they kind of view the U.S. government as this, you know, benevolent force for good in the world. And that's yeah. just their worldview. And so everything that happens in the world, they interpret through that lens. So government officials, you know, policymakers, they can make mistakes sometimes, but they only ever act out of benevolent intent.
Right.
So there was this kind of, you know, and I would refer to that as the state religion in my foreign policy writings. Well, the vaccine religion is a subsect of that, where, you know, there's just like this faith in government agencies like the CDC, the FDA. You know, I mean, you look at, you know, the mainstream media's so-called fact checkers. There's this whole faux fact check industry that has arisen. And they treat the CDC as though whatever the CDC says, whatever the WHO says, the World Health Organization, whatever the FDA says, that's gospel truth. And it's dogma. And we can look back, you know, at the COVID-19, you know, the so-called fact checking that was going on the whole time the vaccines were being rolled out, where, you know, if I was saying something like, well, these vaccines haven't been shown to prevent transmission.
Right. You get
fact-checked for that.
And kicked off. Yeah.
Well, Tony Fauci says, yeah. CDC director says.
Yeah.
It's like, but of course yeah. they were lying.
Yeah.
Right. Which we now know. I mean, they said that this two doses of an mRNA vaccine were going to induce, durable sterilizing immunity and prevent, and it was going to end the pandemic by conferring herd immunity.
Mm-hmm.
That was the promise. It was all lies, as we now know. Yeah. But, you know, so, you know, but the people like correcting that disinformation were being accused of spreading misinformation.
Yeah.
Well, I got kicked off of LinkedIn precisely for correcting, for trying to share a link to an article I'd written, where what I did was I just showed how the CDC's August 2021 claim that the vaccines induce superior immunity to natural immunity.
Right.
Was contradicted at the time by virtually all of the scientific literature. I mean, like all of the non-CDC originating mm-hmm. scientific literature, like show that natural immunity was just vastly superior for many reasons that we could get into. But so it was contradicted at the time by the scientific literature, and later falsified by the CDC's own data as reported by the CDC's own researchers in its own journal.
Did you get back on LinkedIn? Did they let you back on?
They did, interestingly, just kind of more recently. Because I, for a long time, I could not even like log, like check my account. It was just like, if I tried to, like my account was just dead.
Right.
And I couldn't do anything, but I just happened to try again, not too long ago. And I reached a page saying, well, you need to kind of confirm your identity. It let me back into what they call their appeal process.
Okay.
So for a long time I was locked because I had been issued a permanent ban.
Wow.
I had been banned once. And then they let me back in. And then they issued a permanent ban. Not too long ago, I was able to kind of get back into the appeals process, and I actually got my account back. And that to me is interesting because the conclusion I draw from that is that the social media companies are scared right now. They're worried about about lawsuits, and there are a number of
big lawsuits. Facebook seems to have backed off a lot. I'm seeing stuff, and I'm able to post things that that would have gotten me in trouble or just would have not had any views. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope they're scared. I hope that. Do you
it
think
should
that's
be because they were and the case I made with LinkedIn, I explained to them, I said, because I had repeatedly requested them to identify what information that I had shared that they were claiming was false or misleading.
Mm-hmm.
And they refused, like repeatedly. Mm. They would not do that. They could not specify anything, any piece of information that wasn't true. They couldn't do it. And they wouldn't. They wouldn't even attempt to do it. So I just made the argument. I said, well, you claim to offer an appeals process. And you are violating your terms of use with me. You're violating mm-hmm. your user agreement with me by suspending my account on false pretexts and not offering me a legitimate appeals process. Because if I'm not confronted with the accusation,
How can you defend yourself?
With the evidence against me, then there's no way for me to appeal it. There's no way for me to argue, well, that's not true. I can prove that that's true. I'll give you sources. There's no way for me to like even make an argument because they won't even show me. All they did, they said, well, this post contains misinformation. And then I'll be like, well, what is it that's in that post that you're claiming is misinformation? But they won't do that. They'll just have this generic, well, that post was misinformative.
It's very much like accounts you hear about people brought into courts, like in the Soviet Union, where it just reached a point of nonsensicalness, where it's kind of, you know, it's nonsense, and they know it's nonsense, and they know it's nonsense, but it's almost just a display of power. It's almost just, we're gonna say something that's completely nonsensical, and you have to agree with it if you're gonna go on and have a life.
Mm-hmm. That's the appeals process for LinkedIn. Yeah. It's a joke because you go in and they'll say, okay, you can appeal it. If we've blocked this post of yours, but you can appeal it. So the only thing you can do is you appeal, and they make you say, well, you have to explicitly state that you accept the terms of use and the community guidelines. But the thing is that in their community guidelines, they have this statement that says you can't spread misinformation. But within that paragraph talking about misinformation, they say you can't post anything that contradicts information from
the CDC,
public health authorities.
Yeah.
Right. So they're defining. So they're literally defining anything that this goes against, the CDC or the WHO as misinformation.
Right.
And so if you try to post something correcting CDC disinformation, like they're going to say, oh, that's misinformation.
Yeah.
It's this euphemism.
Complete circle.
It's this euphemism that means like it's contrary to official dogma.
Right.
That's what misinformation means.
Which is also straight out of the Soviet Union playbook.
Yeah. And so it's a joke. And then so the appeal process is so you can appeal it. But of course, you don't have any way to like. Again, they don't tell you what specific information that they're even claiming was untrue. And then so all it is like you request an appeal. They have another look and they come back and say, yeah, it was misinformation. And that's it. That's the appeals process.
Wow.
And so, but I managed to get my account back. And I think it was because of the way that I had worded my appeal to really highlight how they were violating. It's not, I'm not the one who violated the terms of
right.
use.
Right. They might be liable.
They did.
Yeah.
They violated their terms of use with me. And I explicitly said that this is another big thing. In my earlier experience, when I got permanently banned, I had said, I had asked them, because of that ambiguity in their community guidelines about, you can't say anything that contradicts public health authorities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I explicitly, specifically asked them, does that mean that I can't share something that's misinformative that contradicts what the authorities say? Or does that prohibit me from sharing truthful information that contradicts the CDC. And they wouldn't answer the question. And they said, we don't offer interpretations of the community guidelines. But of course, to cite the community guidelines and to say, oh, well, you violated the, they have to interpret the community guidelines. They have to interpret them, but they won't share what their interpretation is with you. And so that was a really interesting thing that I discovered, that whole process. And so when I more recently was able to actually get my account back, I made, again, the first step is you have to agree to the community guidelines. So I accepted the community guidelines with the explicit understanding that they do not prohibit me from sharing factually accurate information that contradicts.
So you were able to write in a little addendum.
Yeah, well, it's just part of the appeal. Like it's it triggers like an email exchange.
Okay.
With someone there. And so I was able to write up my understanding, my explicit understanding that I do not recognize that their community guidelines prohibit me from telling the truth.
Nice.
And so that kind of triggered the appeals process on that basis. And then I was able to kind of the way I worded my appeals, and I explained, you know, because they had said, well, there was this and this post that contained misinformation, and this was why you were permanently banned. And I just went through and I said, this was not misinformation, because everything here, and I provided sources, and I said, this is true, and this is true, and this is true, and this is, in fact, for the one post about the CDC, I said, well, the data is from the CDC. So if you're saying we have to trust the CDC, well, here's the study. You can look it up. The study showed that, yeah, natural immunity was superior to two doses of vaccines. So I just provided more support for what I said in the posts. And then I said, again, just, I challenged them to, you know, it's like, if you disagree with something here, specify what it is, specify what the misinformation is. And of course they refused to do it. But I think by also including language in there saying that you're violating your terms of use.
Right.
You violated our user agreement. I think it was that.
I find that when you speak to, we had run-ins with people in the hospitals back in California. And I learned early on that the kind of language you use makes a big difference. And when you use language that even hints at liability, people's ears prick up and they're much more responsive. And so
I was talking to them like a lawyer. I mean, I was using like,
yeah, unfortunately you have to do that. But it's like they're so used to just steamrolling over people that's their default. And only when you say things like, you know, you could be liable, you know, I don't consent, or you could be liable, then it's like, oh, whoops.
Yes. And I had language like that in my appeal.
Yeah.
And I think that's what ultimately did it. And so I'm back on LinkedIn now.
Nice. Awesome. So you're talking about the CDC and how its studies don't actually back up what it says. There was ICANN, the Informed Consent Action Network, sued the CDC a while ago. I don't remember if that was 2000 or 2001, on the autism claim. And my recollection is they basically, you know, the CDC has on its website this statement, vaccines do not cause autism. And here's, you know, and a little thing about here's why, and it lists some studies. And then ICANN sued them and said, you know, please produce the studies, you know, backing up this statement. And they, do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, I don't recall the specifics of that request. ICANN did that. And then, you know, after they had done that, actually for a very short period of time, the CDC actually pulled that headline from that page of its website, you know, the page that says vaccines do not cause autism.
Which I think the lawsuit required them to do, but then they put it back up again.
And they put it back up, yeah.
So they just do what they want.
I don't recall the details of that. It was some time ago now, but so they did succeed in for a moment in time, getting the CDC to kind of withdraw that claim. But of course, the thing about that claim on the CDC's website, again, the CDC makes that claim on that page, and then they cite a number of observational studies and the IOM review that says, well, observational studies are insufficient to either to either prove causality or to disprove causality. And of course, every time an observational study finds an association between vaccine and some harm,
right, then it's just an observational study.
This is just an observational study, and that correlation doesn't necessarily mean causation.
Right, right.
And yet when
they do it,
no association found, it's proof. It's proof, absolute proof of no association.
Yeah.
Completely overlooking the possibility of the type 2 error.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the CDC, in making that claim and citing the IOM review in making that claim, is actually rejecting the standard of evidence adopted by the IOM in that review. The CDC rejects.
Yeah.
And so this is what I mean. Like when the CDC makes claims and you go and you check its sources, and it's not just that the sources don't support what the CDC is claiming, it contradicts what the CDC is saying.
Yeah.
And this is true. You know, if you look at the page on thimerosal is safe, mercury in vaccines is safe, aluminum in vaccines is safe, vaccination during pregnancy with, you know, flu shots is safe. You go to those pages of the CDC's website and you look up the sources and you go read those studies. And they don't support the CDC's claims. They contradict the CDC's claims. Example, with the flu shots for pregnant women. And they cite a number of studies and a bunch of them looked at VAERS data, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And the conclusion from those studies wasn't, this data shows that it's safe to vaccinate women during pregnancy with flu shots. The conclusion was, well, there's a big problem with VAERS data of underreporting.
Yeah.
And it's not really useful for being able to kind of identify, like, you know, to be able to learn, you know, is it safe or not? And so there needs to be further research, you know, using some other type of study design, because if the VAERS data isn't reliable and we can't, because of the underreporting and things like this.
Yeah.
Like the CDC will completely ignore the actual conclusions of the study and the actual findings of the study. And because the study didn't find some harms, and they'll say, this is proof that it's safe to vaccinate pregnant women. But it's like, that's not even what the study authors concluded. Another good example, coming back to autism, the page of the website or that webpage of the CDC's, another study they cite, one of them actually is a study by FDA researchers, which was published in 2001 in Pediatrics. And they'll say, this study shows that thimerosal, you know, is safe and it's not associated with autism. It doesn't cause harm. Actually, the FDA researchers who wrote that study admitted that, of course, that during the 90s, the CDC was exposing children to cumulative levels of mercury in excess of the government's own safety guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the real reason why thimerosal was withdrawn. I mean, when you go to the CDC's webpage and they say, it was just a how do they put it? Out of an abundance of caution. You know, it was a precautionary measure.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
The New York Times, all the media, they always report that, you know, it was just a precaution. You know, it was done out of an abundance of caution. Bull.
Yeah.
I won't use curse words, but BS. That's not true at all. The reason it was withdrawn,
so it was that FDA
study. Completely
panicked
because because the whole time that they were adding more and more mercury containing vaccines to the schedule, nobody in any of these government agencies ever bothered to consider the possible harms that all this mercury could be causing children, and they never actually did the calculations. And it only happened by accident because Congress had tasked the FDA to unrelated to vaccines. But, you know, due to the concerns about mercury exposure from other drugs.
Yeah.
So the Congress tasked the FDA to query the industry for mercury containing products. And of course, along with that, they got a bunch of information about vaccine. And so they got all this data from the industry and they actually got around to doing the calculations. Showing that, the CDC was following the CDC schedule, exposed children to cumulative levels of mercury in excess of the government's own guidelines.
Yeah.
And that's why it was removed, because they completely panicked. They were so concerned about liability issues of continuing to include mercury in these vaccines. That's why it was done. So when you hear the media tell you that it was done out of abundance of caution and there was no evidence that this was causing harm, that's nonsense.
Wow.
That's a complete lie.
Wow.
So anyways, that's one of the studies the CDC cites. And of course, the FDA researchers in that 2001 pediatric study that disclosed this information to the public, they also expressed, you know, they said that, you know, ethyl mercury, because this is one of the CDC's claims, that ethyl mercury, right, the form of mercury in vaccines, is different from methyl mercury, and mm-hmm. it's non-toxic.
Right, it's that it doesn't toxic stay
like the mercury in fish.
Yeah, like it isn't the argument that it gets flushed right out of your system and it doesn't.
Yeah, because they say that it's readily and rapidly eliminated from the body, and so it can't cause toxicity. That's the CDC's argument. And to support that argument, they cite a 2005 study, which FDA researchers have incidentally described as the best study for comparison of toxicity between ethyl mercury and methyl mercury. And this is another big thing, because when the CDC, when the FDA did those calculations, right, of the cumulative levels of mercury that children were being exposed to, and the safety guidelines that they compared that with wasn't for ethyl mercury, it was for methyl mercury. Why? Because they have never established safety guidelines for ethyl mercury. The safety guidelines don't exist to this day. So they couldn't compare to any safety guidelines for ethyl mercury because I've never done the research.
Wow.
So again, you know, out of an abundance of caution, no. And so that was one thing. And so these researchers who did this study in 2005, that was one of their big conclusions, was that the FDA's reliance on methyl mercury toxicity studies as a basis for, you know, guessing at the safety of ethyl mercury is scientifically invalid.
Mm-hmm.
That was one. And they confirmed that another big thing that they'll do is they'll say, oh, well, you know, they have these studies of like looking at the mercury levels in the blood. And one of the studies was like, oh, well, look at the mercury levels in the blood. It was after such and such number of days, you know, it was the half-life is you know, the mercury is just so rapidly eliminated from circulation. Well, the big question is, well, where does it go? Because they didn't show that it was eliminated from the body.
Right.
And so this 2005 study, you know, looked at that question, and they determined that it's true that ethyl mercury is more rapidly eliminated from the blood than methyl mercury, but it's more persistent in the brain, because once the ethyl mercury gets in the brain, it breaks down to inorganic mercury, which is persistent. And it does so more than methyl mercury does. So methyl mercury, when it's in the brain, it's easier to be eliminated from the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when ethyl mercury gets in there, it's persistent. And so you have this.
Does it never come out? Does it just?
I think it does over time. But again, this is also on an individual basis. You know, some children have a greater ability to detox, and eliminate heavy metals from their body, and some children just have. They're just incapacitated. They're not able to do that, whether it's because of some mitochondrial disorder or whatever it might be, you know, lack of glutathione, whatever it might be, they're not as able to detox as other children. And so those children are at higher risk.
Yeah.
And this is the big lie from the CDC. The CDC claims that, you know, mercury, it's so rapidly eliminated from the body, it can't possibly cause toxicity. Well, and it cites this study from 2005 to support that claim.
Unbelievable.
And the conclusions of the authors of that study was actually that, number one, this safety comparison that they're doing is scientifically invalid. Number two, that while it's true that it's more rapidly eliminated from the blood than methyl mercury, it's more persistent in the brain. And number three, this is the big conclusion that they drew. They actually, contrary to the way the CDC characterizes the study, the authors of the studies themselves said that, you know, they explained that mercury in the brain is associated with this inflammatory state. And this inflammatory state, in turn, is associated with autism. And so they expressed concern about like the IOM's conclusion in 2004 that no further safety research needs to be done into this question, you know, like, and they said, well, this that doesn't make any sense because of the concerns about how mercury in the brain can cause inflammation, which is a known, you know, that state of inflammation in the brain is known to be associated with autism. So I mean the mechanisms are known. The biological plausibility is there, as admitted by the IOM, that it's biologically plausible that vaccines could cause autism, at least in genetically susceptible children. And so this was what the finding of that study was. This is what the authors concluded, that it's a very big concern. They were concerned about their finding, and they expressed that concern in the paper. And that's a paper that the CDC uses.
It's astonishing to
support the claim
that
vaccines don't cause autism.
Yeah, it's just when you look at things like that, to me, it's astonishing. It's like you people must really think that everyone out there is an idiot. Or that nobody's, I can understand taking a gamble and thinking, well, only, 10% of the people who look at this page are going to bother to go and look in at the study and see what it says. But what about that 10%? I mean, it's like they have no regard for what they're actually, I guess what it is I think they must understand that what they do isn't limited by the truth, that there is no check on them, that they can get away with anything, really.
Yeah, they lie with impunity. The CDC mm-hmm. lies with impunity.
Yeah,
and of course, the mainstream media, when the mainstream media misinform people about vaccines, they're just following the CDC's example.
Yeah.
And so, when they treat the CDC as this like sacrosanct agency, that's like this, we should bow at the altar of the CDC, right?
Yeah.
And worship vaccines and the vaccine religion, because this, as though the CDC, whatever the CDC says is gospel truth, and that the media literally treat the CDC that way. It's crazy. It's insane. Because of course the CDC is completely untrustworthy. It's proven its untrustworthiness time and time again, continuously proves its untrustworthiness.
For anyone who's paying attention,
Mercury issue in the 90s and the level of mercury that it was exposing children to the aluminum issue, which of course, as they phase out mercury, they increase the number of the amount of aluminum that children were exposed to. Also, they started recommending flu shots for pregnant women and for infants as young as 6 months annually. Mm-hmm. And look at the whole COVID-19 vaccines and all the lies the public were told about those vaccines and how safe and effective they were.
And maybe it took that level of attention, that level of something that's so in the public eye for enough people to kind of recognize what they're, what the CDC has up to. Because I think, there's definitely more awareness now.
It's one of the silver linings of the pandemic is that there's just been such a huge awakening. There really has been a mass awakening, like a big shift. And we're still a long way from where we need to be.
It's so much farther than
like,
we
if
were.
You just compare like pre-COVID to now in terms of people's awareness of like how untrustworthy the CDC is, there's just no comparison.
Yeah.
I mean, for the CDC's untrustworthiness to be actually part of the mainstream discourse.
Yeah.
There's discussions about it, right? In the mainstream media now. Like before that was just, you couldn't even find that.
No, you'd be dismissed as a kook.
Right. You're like a conspiracy. You don't trust the CDC. What are you, a conspiracy theorist?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's just been a huge change in terms of just awareness of the problem of how the vaccines were rushed to market, emergency use authorization without really good data, and how they, and of course they ended the trials. I mean, trials continued, but they vaccinated away the control group.
Right. There's no control group.
So we would never have the long-term data.
Yeah.
So it just, just to me, that was before they were licensed.
Yeah.
They didn't even wait for them to be licensed before they did that. They did that immediately upon emergency use.
Right. After what, like 3 months or something? It was.
Yeah. I think it was about 3 months.
Before, it was ridiculous.
They just kind of essentially ended the study for all useful purposes,
by
vaccinating away the placebo group.
Yeah.
And so that to me was criminal. I mean, the whole rollout and the way, I mean, I have an ebook that I've given away free for newsletter subscribers, where I look at the FDA's explanation for its authorization of the vaccines for infants and toddlers. And it's just the amount of scientific fraud in that FDA document I mean, I wrote a whole book about it because it's just, it's like, it's one thing after another.
If people go to your website, they can sign up for your newsletter and get that book.
Yeah, actually right now I've replaced that one with a new one. I've got a new ebook out right now.
Okay.
Which is The New York Times versus Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Ah.
Which is a case study, again, in how the mainstream media spread vaccine misinformation. Nice. Of course, attacking Bobby Kennedy, is spreading misinformation. And yet in this article that I use as a case study from The Times, they actually don't identify even a single thing that he's ever said that isn't true. And it's kind of a case study in how propaganda works.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I'm offering for free right now. But of course, you know, people can still get the other book from me.
Okay. Okay.
But I haven't set it up to be able to make that easy to get access to right now, but I will make that more available.
Okay.
I'll share the link. There's another link to get that one as well.
Okay.
But yeah, so right now you can get the New York Times case study, where they try to, nice. You know, they attack Bobby Kennedy, of course, because of his presidential candidacy, was kind of the impetus for this New York Times article. And I just go through and I show how actually the New York Times, who's misleading and lying about quite a number of things. One example being, it starts out, the New York Times article starts out accusing Bobby of, he gave that talk. There was the protest. There was a protest in Washington, I believe it was. And he gave a talk where he mentioned, he talked about Nazi Germany. And he said something to the fact of how people could flee, you know, over the mountains, or, you know, like Anne Frank hidden in the attic. And he was talking about, and so they had that, this, they quote that statement of his out of context. And they say, oh, he was saying that, that people, you know, Americans who were, you know, choosing not to get the COVID-19 vaccines, were more persecuted than Jews in Nazi Germany. And that's what they claim he said, which is ludicrous, right? That's and you go and watch the video. And so they take that one statement. And the ironic thing about this is, of course, the whole claim that the New York Times makes, whether it's like its article description, is that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Spreads misinformation by taking things out of context. And the very first thing that the Times does is to take
it out
that
of context. Statement of
his completely out of its context, because what he was actually talking about was the technological capabilities that governments have today to be mm-hmm. able to surveil and control the population. You know, he's talking about
things to like understand
satellite
that.
Surveillance. You have, you know, you're talking about like central bank digital currencies in China, the social credit system, you know, the surveillance cameras on every street corner. I mean, drones. He's talking about the technologies that governments have to be able to like monitor and control the population. And what he was saying is that, you know, like if we don't act to fight for our freedom, like we're going to be looking at this dystopian future where, yeah, people, you know, you won't be able to flee over the mountains. You won't be able to hide. There will be no place to run, no place to hide. That was the point he was making,
mm-hmm.
which is, of course, a completely different point,
right.
A legitimate point.
But that's how propaganda works, isn't it? It's like you can make a bizarre statement about what somebody said. And it's like just the same thing with the CDC. They can say whatever they want. And it's only the people who make the effort to go and look at the source material who can then say, well, no, that's not what it was at all. And that's how they get away with it, because most people they're not going to make that effort. They don't have the attention for that, but they'll mm-hmm. still retain the message, you know, RFK right. bad, RFK Jr. bad, bad Nazi. And so
yeah, on and that, it took me a little bit of time to track down that video. I couldn't find it right away. Cause of course they don't link
you gotta
to
make
it.
An effort.
They don't link to
no,
it.
Of so course you can go not. Of course not.
They link to a clip where it's just that one clip. Right. But they don't show the whole statement. They don't show the whole context of the statement.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's one of the big things. You know, it seems like 90% of my articles or more, it's like, here's what the media is saying.
Refuting the New York Times.
Here's what their
Times.
Sources say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on the topic of smear campaigns, we can't really talk about vaccines and autism without talking about Wakefield.
Yeah.
So, and I've written about this too, because it's so in your face. It's so blatant. that every single mainstream article talking about vaccines and autism will say, the only reason to think that there's any connection was this fraudulent paper by this doctor who's been discredited and, you know, kicked out of his profession and had his license taken away. And, you know, there's no reason to think that there's anything. And people, and it gets repeated over and over again. It's so easily falsifiable. It's not at all what happened. And yet it's repeated over and over again. And so, again, the people who don't bother to look beneath the surface come away believing that's true. What's the actual truth about Wakefield?
There's so many lies in that obligatory statement that every media article says about that paper. Number one, the hypothesis that vaccines might cause autism did not originate with that paper. In fact, if you read in the paper itself, the link that supposedly, you know, was made, they claimed a link between vaccines and autism. The only link that they claimed was that there was in the paper is a temporal association, which is completely uncontroversial. That, yeah, because autism is generally diagnosed around the age that, you know, that children, this is the excuse that the media give. It's like, oh, it's just a coincidence because that's just the age that children receive their diagnosis. It wasn't from the MMR vaccine. So that this temporal association exists isn't even controversial. So it's just for pointing that out, because it was the parents or the doctors who were reporting to Wakefield and his co-authors that there was, you know, they were concerned that the developmental regression occurred after receipt of the MMR vaccine. So they just put that information in the paper. They shared this knowledge of this. That was the only link. They didn't claim that there's a causal association. They didn't claim to have found a causal association. So that's one. So the first big lie is that, you know, that they say that this was the whole origin of the whole idea. That's false. You can go back to 1991 and another IOM review in 1991. Guess what they talked about? Parental concerns of vaccines causing autism. This goes back into the 80s, the early 80s. It didn't originate in 1998 with a Lancet paper by Wakefield. The second big lie is they always only mention Wakefield as though he was the only author.
Yeah.
He had 12 co-authors, including a preeminent gastroenterologist named Dr. John Walker Smith. So there's another lying by omission, as though he was the only author. And there's a good reason for them not to mention Walker Smith, who was the senior author of the paper, because and when you read journal papers, typically the lead author, the first name in the byline is considered the lead author, which Wakefield was on this paper. But the very last author named is typically considered the senior author. And for that paper, Walker Smith was the senior author of that paper. He was also the gastroenterologist who treated these children, the 12 children. So, and it was a case series, the type of study it was a case series. So they looked at 12 children who presented with developmental regression and gut dysfunction. And that was the big finding of the study. This is another thing that the media don't talk about, was that actually the significant finding of the study was that there is this associate. This was the big association that they found. Mm-hmm. There's an association between autism and the gut, which Wakefield pioneered research into studies of the role of the gut in autism. And he's never credited for it. This is huge. Like, he pioneered that research and he's not credited for it. He's demonized, which is infuriating. But that was the finding of that study. That was the finding of that study. And they have a really good reason for not mentioning Walker Smith's role in that study, which is that John Walker Smith appealed. So what happened was the study was retracted in 2010 or 2011, I think, which was, you know, a decade. It was like a decade after the study was published, right? And the reason for the retraction was not fraud. If you can go and read the statement of retraction on the Lancet website, it's not, they don't say, well, we're retracting this because of fraud. There was fraudulent data or something. They don't claim that at all. They say it's because of the ruling of the General Medical Council in the GMC in the UK, because the GMC had stripped Wakefield and Walker Smith of their medical licenses on the grounds that they had committed professional misconduct. Not fraud, mm-hmm. professional misconduct.
Yeah.
And the two big charges that they used to support this charge of professional misconduct was one that they had said that the children were consecutively referred to Walker Smith's gastroenterology department.
Mm-hmm.
The GMC misinterpreted what that even means and so attributed to them a meaning that they hadn't even intended. All they meant was like, yeah, they weren't referred
all at once
as a single batch. It was one after the other. And then the second one was that they didn't have ethics approval from a local ethics board for the study. And so that was the basis for the accusation of professional misconduct, which is the reason for the retraction of the study. Walker Smith appealed and he won and he got his medical license back. The reason he got his medical license back was because the appeals court, the high court, found that the GMC's accusations were untenable and unsupported by the evidence. That's the true story. Wakefield didn't join Walker Smith because his insurance wouldn't cover the legal costs.
Right.
But of course, the media never mentioned any of this. They say that the origin of the vaccine autism hypothesis was this study. This was the origin of the whole thing. You know, go back to the early 80s, parents were concerned about vaccines causing autism, which is why the IOM talked about it in its 1991 review. So there's that big lie. They only mentioned Wakefield as though he's the only author, when in fact he had co-authors, and Walker Smith appealed and won, got back his medical license. Of course, they never want to talk about that because that undermines the whole basis for the retraction.
Yeah. And those other co-authors, isn't it interesting that it was only Wakefield, Walker Smith, and I think one other who refused to sign the retraction of an interpretation.
Yes.
so why did they have their licenses attacked, but the 10 others who signed that, why did they not have their licenses attacked? You know, it just doesn't make sense.
I think one of the reasons was, I don't know, that's a question I've had too. Like, why was it only the lead author and the senior author?
Yeah.
And the others were just kind of like exonerated of any fault. I think there's two reasons. One is because, Wakefield as the lead author and he was kind of the big mover behind the whole study. He was kind of the guy who kind of organized the whole thing and pulled it together. And Walker Smith was, of course, the clinician. Mm-hmm. Who actually saw these patients. And so I think they kind of targeted them because of those two kind of leading roles in the study. But also I think it helped those other authors to publish that retraction of an interpretation, which is ridiculous. It's nonsensical.
Yeah.
They didn't retract anything they said in the study. In fact, they reaffirmed what they found in the study, but they were essentially kind of saying that, well, this interpretation of the study that there's an association between vaccines and autism, like we're disavowing that. So it's completely meaningless.
Yeah.
But I think by doing that, I think they kind of like took the target off of their backs. Although Walker Smith did sign that too. I think because of his more central role, like it's like they couldn't really go after Wakefield only.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's not even the one who like saw the patients, you know, like he wasn't the one who treated the patients. And so coming back to the appeal, I mentioned about why they had taken that statement about consecutive referral completely out of context, as the high court, the appeals court ruled. So that statement in the paper wasn't false. It wasn't untrue. It was just an accurate statement. But the second big thing was that they didn't need ethics approval from the local review board, because the procedures that were done under John Walker Smith's, under his clinical care, they were necessary for diagnosis and treatment. They were clinically indicated. For diagnosis and treatment, In fact, as a result of the children undergoing those procedures, some of them got better. And they had marked improvements as a result. And so the high court ruled, you know, that whole charge was untenable because he didn't need ethics approval because he didn't conduct those procedures for the purpose of research. It was to help the children. The procedures were clinically indicated. And so that's how he got his medical license back. And those were the two charges that the Lancet cited for the retraction. And so, yeah, that whole, the whole Wakefield thing, like you said, it's every, you practically can't
it's
read.
It's obligatory. It's like a catechism. I call it the Wakefield catechism. You know, it's like you have to repeat this in order to.
And it's just like, and they'll summarize that episode in history in like a sentence or two.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in those two sentences is contained so much misinformation.
Yeah.
And and I unpack that in the book that you can get on my website right now. If you go to my website and sign up for my newsletter, the New York Times versus Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I unpack that.
Oh,
as
nice.
Well,
okay. Book,
because of course the New York Times mentions the Wakefield study. So.
Of course they do. Of course.
So I do address that in that ebook as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, it's sickening because, you know, you understand why Wakefield is viewed as a hero by so many parents.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And not as a villain. And that pisses off the media so much.
Yeah. Good.
But he really is. I mean, how he pioneered this research into, and which is now well recognized. I mean,
right.
Today,
there was a big study from UC Davis, right? Just recently, there was kind of finding the same thing or.
Yeah. They're like confirming what Wakefield was saying back then. And of course, nobody ever gives him credit for pioneering research into that whole field. But, you know, there's all kinds of studies now on like the role of the gut microbiome.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like the role of leaky gut with autism, because there's a gut brain axis, leaky gut, leaky brain kind of thing.
Yeah.
And if you have leaky brain, if stuff can get through your blood brain barrier more easily, the same way, like I used to suffer leaky gut. And so, I used to have all kinds of, I couldn't eat foods that, you know, I could, most of my life I had no problem with. But suddenly I was reacting. I was having like rashes or migraines, like from gluten, dairy, soy. Actually, not just gluten, any grains for me.
Oh, wow. Wow. Rice.
Even rice, corn, the so-called gluten-free grains. Because they have, actually, one of the things I learned was that because they also have similar proteins that some people, including celiac patients, there's a subset of celiac patients who also can't have corn or rice or other like supposedly gluten-free grains.
So it's not the gluten, it's just the grains.
Because the proteins that are contained that... It's like gluten,
right?
And they're
so
similar that there's this cross reactivity, and so I had to cut out like all grains.
Wow!
And like I couldn't eat anything with grains, dairy, soy. There was basically 95% of what's on the grocery store shelf, I couldn't eat it. And so for a number of years, I had to just like so I was basically on an elimination diet. To heal my gut, and also just trying to eating organic was a big thing, because I think glyphosate exposure wasn't really that aware of the problem, and I think glyphosate exposure was a big cause of my gut problems. And so like eating organic foods as much as possible, just avoiding anything GMO.
Yeah.
But another thing is like, especially like bread. If you're going to buy bread, like you have to buy organic bread because they desiccate, even though it's not GMO. Like the wheat is not GMO.
It's covered in
pesticides.
But they
desiccate the crop with glyphosate before harvesting. And so if you're not eating organic bread, your chances are you're being contaminated with, you're being exposed to glyphosate. And so, just making dietary changes, I was able to kind of heal my gut. It's not 100%. It's not back to where it was. But I can eat, I can enjoy all the foods that, I used to enjoy. I can have cheese. It doesn't cause me migraines and things. I can have soy, the gluten-free, organic soy. My wife's Taiwanese. So
she's got that under control.
Her cooking style. So
I remember some amazing soy dishes.
In a way for me, like all this, like allergen-free, style of cooking that's done in like this Asian way. It's really phenomenal.
That's amazing
what she was able to do. So she kind of helped me heal with her amazing cooking.
Nice.
But you know, so you know, point being, so I've experienced leaky gut myself, and so the thing is that what happens is normally the gut lining breaks down, and normally that would serve as part of the immune system.
Yeah.
And it would serve as a barrier, yeah. And it would only allow in, you know, like you want the nutrition, you want the nutrients,
mm-hmm.
you want those to be absorbed, but everything else, you
right,
you
don't not want the bacteria absorbed. Necessarily.
And it's kind of like the opposite happens with leaky gut, where you have a hard time absorbing nutrients, and so you kind of have malnutrition, and you're not getting. And like one of my symptoms, for example, was like my fingers and hands would just like tingle. All that tend to be like tingly, this weird tingling sensation, like you're falling asleep, right? And it, just researching that, I determined that to be a B12 deficiency. And so I started supplementing the more bioavailable form of B12, which is methylcobalamin, because my body, I just couldn't get the nutrients. And so I had to supplement it in addition, and lo and behold,
and that worked.
Yeah, the tingling went away, and it took a number of years. It took a couple of years of just like that elimination process of before I could kind of reintroducing things without having like those immune reactions.
Yeah.
Leaky gut is a condition where it's you have a harder time absorbing the nutrients you need, and yet larger molecules of things that that your body doesn't recognize as nutritious, and it stimulates this immune response. And of course the doctors that I tried to get help from, were less than useless. And they would say, oh, well you have food allergies. And I'm like, I've never had food allergies. I don't have food allergies. And I would say, no, I had diagnosed myself.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
mm-hmm.
PubMed.gov and I went into the literature and I looked up my symptoms and I just read hundreds and hundreds of papers. You know, and you, if you go into the literature and you go to PubMed.gov and you search leaky gut, and then you search, do a separate search and you do intestinal hyperpermeability, there's just thousands of studies. And yet I had doctors like I was literally like laughed out of the office by doctors.
Wow.
When
did
I brought
you,
it up.
Did you finally find someone who would work with you?
I did have a PCP at one point for a short period of time. I had lived in Taiwan for a number of years. And when my wife and son and I moved back to the U.S. here in Michigan in 2013, and I got established with a doctor, and he like just denied that leaky gut existed. He just denied that it was a thing. And I ended my relationship with him at one point. He, in addition to like just not wanting to hear me anymore, because like he would be like, it doesn't exist, it's not a problem, or he would say something like I would tell him, well, actually gluten it can actually contribute to leaky gut, because gluten causes the gut lining to become more permeable. And he's like, no, it doesn't. Like, he's denying all the stuff like I've read, and that's like, I could give him the sources if he bothered to be curious about it, but he was just like just super ignorant guy.
Wow.
And then the very last time I went to see him, they offered a flu shot, which I declined. And so after I pissed him off by insisting that he didn't know what he was talking about, because he hadn't done the research in literature like I had, he stormed out on me. And then he came walking back into the office and he said, by the way, any husband who doesn't, you know, any man in the family who doesn't get a flu shot is not a good patient. And when he said that to me, I was sitting on the table, right? And I like flew off the table because he was standing in the doorway to look him right in the eye. And I said, what did you just say to me? And he turned around and walked away, and he was like kind of storming down the hall towards his office. And I followed after him and speaking quite loudly so the other staff in the clinic could hear. And I said, you are so ignorant. And I said, go to PubMed.gov and look up leaky gut. Look it up. And then he walked into his office and slammed the door closed. And
you know, you could have a whole reality show of, or not a reality show, but you'd have a whole show of people talking about their experiences with doctors like this one. I mean, it's just, it's incredible, but there are so many.
And he wasn't the only one. He wasn't the only one. And then after that, I did find a PCP who, like, I went in to see him and explained, you know, I was really fearful that I was going to have the same reaction. This guy actually was like, I believe you. And he said, I only know about leaky gut. I actually heard about this before because I went to a conference once and they talked about it. And he amazingly enough, he said to me, You know a lot more about it than I do. A doctor admitting that
Yeah, with our daughter's condition, we've had a few doctors who are the first, I think the first genetic specialist we met with, who said that, will say that to us. And it's just, to me, it's a good indication of some level of humility. Mm-hmm. And I've just found, we've been through a lot of doctors and we've had some crazy experiences too. But the one thing that makes it unworkable is arrogance. If they're, and it's pervasive in the industry, but if they're so arrogant that they can't hear you, you know, when you're maybe contradicting what they knew the day before, you just can't work with them.
Yeah. And unfortunately that one good doctor that I had who at least listened to me and like would respect me and acknowledge that I actually know more about it than him. I unfortunately didn't have him for very long because he retired. And the reason he retired, he told me the last time I saw him, he said he was retiring because his words, I can't practice medicine anymore. That's why he quit.
Yep.
And so I had to get another guy. And then, but before that I had gone to, because that first PCP I had who, you know, was just completely ignorant and just denied that leaky gut even existed, even though, again, you can go into the literature and there's just thousands of studies about it.
Right.
But he insisted that it was just regular like food allergies. And so he sent me, and of course, he did the blood test for allergies, which of course came back negative. And I was like, see, I told you, I don't have allergies. And then, so he sent me to an allergy specialist. And that guy, I walked into his office and I said, I don't have food allergies. We're going to do this skin prick test, but I'll tell you right now, it's going to come back negative because I don't have allergies. I have leaky gut. And he said to me, you read a lot on the internet, don't you? And I was so offended. And so I said,
shame on you.
I said, well, yeah, I go to PubMed.gov and I read the medical literature. And I thought, but I didn't say it out loud, I thought, you should try it sometime. But, you know, that's the level of arrogance and condescension of doctors. And the thing is, they don't know what they don't know. Like they have no comprehension of just how ignorant they are.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like a lot of these guys, they get out of medical school and like, that's it. They're done with they're done with education, right? They're not going to, there's no need to like keep up with the science and read studies and go in, do their own research. It's like they were trained in how to do medicine and they're just going to practice medicine.
We've all been trained to see them as gods. So they're used to having people come into their office and just saying, you know, tell me what to do.
Right.
I'll do whatever say. And yeah.
And that was their solution, their answer to everything. You know, oh, well, you have itchy rashes. Oh, here's some Zyrtec.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's it.
Don't and then bother I started, trying which, to find course, out.
I was grateful for it because, you know, I mean, I could sleep at night because, you know, there were times where I was just like so miserable. I couldn't sleep and things.
But not just, no like, effort to like find out the real source.
But yeah, that was never like the solution for me. It was like, I wanted to know what the cause is.
Yeah.
And treat that.
Yeah.
As opposed to treating the symptom. And actually, the Zyrtec started causing me problems. I started having heart issues as a result.
Oh, wow.
It's like these palpitations, these skipped beats from the Zyrtec. And it was clear. Like I could stop it and restart it and they'd come back. And I could stop it and start it and it would come back. You know, like it would go away. And it was just very clearly caused by the antihistamine.
Wow.
And fortunately, again, my wife came to the rescue. She mixed up some, she created a lotion and a spray, and it was just like peppermint spray with some other like essential oils and things. And I could use that and I could spray it on wherever, you know, I had itchy rash or something. And like, if I was itchy, I would spray it. And it was like really soothing. And it just like, it eliminated the itch. And so that's how I was able to like wean myself off of Zyrtec.
Nice.
Just, you know, like essential oils.
Have you ever tried Chinese medicine?
I haven't. No, but my wife has. You know, she has used, you know, various
here in the States.
They have like traditional Chinese medicine doctors over in Taiwan, and you know,
they'll give you
all these like roots and herbs and things like that.
Yeah, I remember. I visited. I had friends who went when I was living in Hong Kong. I had friends who saw a Chinese medicine doctor, and I went a couple times, and some really amazing stories, like just stuff that's almost like supernatural, just wild stories. But yeah, all the, and then you go to the herbal shops and it's like, you know, dried lizards and, you know, herbs and everything.
Yeah, they have some strange things. I've been into like the stores, the clinics. They have some strange things on the shelves.
So today,
as a result of going through the process of just allowing my gut to heal, and again, it's, you know, it's nowhere near 100% like it was when in my youth. I can still, if I eat too much gluten, for example, I can still get itchy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't suffer from, you know, I used to have hives and other forms of other types of rashes and just like itchiness, terrible migraines. And I can't even remember the last time I had a migraine. It's like healing my gut made those symptoms go away. But I had to do that. I had to diagnose and treat myself because the doctors were, again, less than useless.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they were useless.
They made it worse than useless.
Yes. If I had just listened to them, I would be much worse.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's often the case. And again, talking silver linings with COVID, I think that's something that's also sort of coming to the forefront now that, you know, you can't just trust your doctor. Right. You really got to be informed. And the ones who like try and belittle you for going on the internet or, you know, getting your own information, it's like, that's a red flag. Research. Right. Run away from that person. As you say, it's not just that they're not going to help you. They can cause harm. And
yes.
And
can and will.
Yeah. Harm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been great. We covered a lot of ground here.
Yeah, we went to some areas I didn't expect, but it's
but it all kind of links together. You know, vaccines, autism, gut, brain. Anything else? Anything we've forgotten to bring up?
Oh gosh, there's so many rabbit holes and so, I know. So far down, and then you go down one rabbit hole, and then you find three more rabbit holes.
That's the thing I think
that people really need to understand. It's like, you have to do your own research.
Yeah.
You can't, like, if you go on into the pediatrician and they give you the vaccine information sheet and it's two pages, it's nothing.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, that's not informed consent. If that's how you make your vaccine decisions, is you read that and you say, oh, well, the CDC says it's safe and effective and I should do this. That's not informed consent.
No.
You have to do your own research on every vaccine. You know, every vaccine.
Yeah, on every medical treatment. It's not just
every
vaccines,
treatment, every drug, every biologic. You can't trust the CDC. You can't trust the FDA. You can't trust the public health establishment in general. You can't trust your doctors.
Yeah.
You can't trust the media. You can't trust scientists, you know, who publish studies in the literature, because they'll lie to you too, and they'll commit fraud.
And so you have to
do your own research, and you have to really think for yourself, and you have to learn how to do critical thinking.
Yeah. To bring it around to your book again, The War on Informed Consent, I think, you know, one of the biggest lessons there is about the world we live in, the doctors we see, that institution. It's not that doctors are bad and want to be telling you lies. It's that their career's on the line if they don't, you know, they're.
Right. Yes. And that's one thing that I mentioned in the book is, you know, you have to understand doctors have their own confirmation biases.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so you can understand a doctor like wanting to do good for his patients. It's not that they're bad people. Yeah. They want to do good for children, but it takes a certain kind of rare personality for a doctor to like question and say, is what I'm doing, is it maybe not helping, but is it maybe causing harm? And Dr. Thomas was that rare individual.
Yeah, he was.
Who was willing to, number one, ask himself that question.
Yeah.
And then two, actually try to search and find an answer to it. So super rare. He's just a gift. You know, he's a treasure.
He really is. Yeah.
And so, definitely read The War on Informed Consent. And again, like you mentioned earlier, it's not, I mean, the book is about his story, but it's so much bigger than that. It's just like this. It's like a glimpse. It's like a picture of what's happening and how they're really waging war on our right to informed consent. You know, they're going after parents first. Mm-hmm. And then when parents find doctors who are able to kind of empower them to be able to make their own informed choices, then they go after those doctors. So they're trying to eliminate any way for us to be able to exercise informed consent. And that's what the book is about, really. Yeah. And it gives all kinds of historical information, you know, like the historical context you need to understand the relevance and importance of his story.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of puts his story into this bigger picture and into this bigger perspective, including, you know, like I discuss, you know, the whole thing with mercury, children being exposed to levels of mercury in excess of the government's own guidelines, and all that information is in there. I discuss the Wakefield paper. So it gives all kinds of information. So it's not just, you know, about Dr. Thomas and his study and medical board's persecution of him. There's all kinds of, it's Tom Woods. And I was on his show, and he gave me a nice compliment. He talked about how he said it's a deceptively short book because it's not a very long read, but he says it's just packed with information. So there you have it. Don't take my word for it.
It tells this tremendously important story. I feel like Dr. Thomas is kind of the perfect illustration, sort of the center point of this story, but the story is really much bigger than him. It's something that we're all kind of living through in many ways.
Yeah. And it's about standing up for our rights and standing up, empowering yourself with the knowledge to be able to gain the confidence to stand up and speak out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what needs to happen because we've come a long way again as a result of the overreach by the public health establishment and the blatant brazen lying about the COVID-19 vaccines and the lockdowns and the masks and all of it. But we have a long way to go. And I think everyone has a role to play in affecting this mass awakening because we need to reach a critical mass of educated, informed citizenry for things to change. You know, we need to make it politically infeasible for business to continue as usual with the CDC's one-size-fits-all approach to disease, to infectious disease. And so I think we all have a duty to get informed, educate ourselves, ask questions, think critically. And then when we have knowledge, we need to share it with others. And again, going back, when I started doing vaccine research, it was to make my own decisions as a father. But then it was once I had that information, you know, because I was writing on foreign policy issues or economic issues, Federal Reserve. Right. I was focused on other issues with my journalism. But I reached a point where I was like, I can't not share this information with others.
Yeah.
And I knew what that was going to do in terms of like putting a huge target on my back for all the attacks that were going to come my way. But like I had to start speaking out against the public vaccine policy. To the point where I had shifted my focus entirely to the vaccine issue. And then COVID-19 came and, of course, focused entirely on that. It's just too important. It's just too important an issue. That's kind of my takeaway message. I think it's just like everyone needs to do their part and do their duty to help affect the mass awakening so that things can change. And I am hopeful. I'm very optimistic. I think that someday in the future, when civilized humanity looks back on our present age, they'll recognize the policy of mass vaccination as barbaric.
Yep, I agree. Thank you so much. This has been great and hope to have you back on again soon.
Absolutely. It's always good to talk to you. Thanks.
You've been listening to What Then Must We Do, the podcast for those who understand that the state is the problem and are seeking solutions. For more episodes, go to bretney.substack.com. That's bretigne.substack.com and subscribe.